Hi friends, you're listening to Convos with me, Kathy Clark. Gary and I are the lead pastors at Hillsong Church in the UK. I'm so happy to have you join us in the conversation today. This program is for you, and really all we're doing is having a good, honest talk about real life stories. So whether you're on your daily commute, you're in the car, or you're at home with a coffee, sit back and I hope you enjoy today's chat. And by the way, don't forget to join the conversation on Instagram using the hashtag Convos with Kathy. Hi there, and Merry Christmas to everyone. Today I'm sitting down for a chat with a remarkable young woman who is not allowing the difficulties that she's been through in life to set her back, but instead is drawing from those experiences to propel her into opportunities that make life better for others facing similar struggles. This December 25th, we'll again be hosting Christmas dinner for a group of foster care leavers who might otherwise have no place to go. Of course, we look forward to lavishing them with love in every detail possible, from the warm welcome to the amazing food, from the place settings and to the party vibes. And the founder of this brilliant tradition is none other than the girl sitting across from me, and her name is Charlize Lawrence. Charlize is going to share with us some of her experiences as a kid growing up in foster care, some of the misconceptions that we might have of families in that scenario. And so thank you, Charlize. Actually, before you say anything, I just want to say that we really want to take this opportunity to honour you, because you have done something that is incredible and remarkable for a group of people that may easily have gone unnoticed. And so we just want to do a big shout out to you and honour you for what you've done. And we know that it's been a stretch. I know that it's been a stretch for you, but we really do honour what you've done and how you've stepped out and chosen to do this. And this is just one little part of your life. So welcome, Charlize.
Thank you for having me.
Yay. All right then. So we have talked a little bit about the Christmas dinner, but I want to just go back a little bit to digging into the reasons why you would even want to go there, which means then we need to go back a little bit to your past, where you grew up, how you grew up. So do you want to just shed a bit of light on that for us?
Yeah. So essentially, I grew up on an estate.
In London?
In London, sorry. I grew up on an estate in London called Chingford Hall Estate.
Yeah.
With my mum. So my mum was my sole parent that looked after me and my brother. And the environment that we kind of grew up in was, I guess, it was, for us, normal. But when other people would look from the outside, it was a bit chaotic, a bit crazy, a bit, I'd say, like, gangland-y.
Yeah.
But for us, it was just, you know, I guess, normal life. So, you know, I grew up around people selling drugs and, you know, carrying knives and guns and just doing crazy stuff that you wouldn't necessarily see just on a like everyday basis. And so growing up there, for me, I was like, oh, this is cool, this is life, this is just normal. I would see stuff and just be like, oh, that's nothing. Like, you know, you would randomly see someone walking around with a machete and then, you know, running away from the police or like stuff like that. And so it was just for me, that was just like, oh, this
is just normal.
It's where I live. And so I feel like One of the biggest things for me growing up was when I initially went into care, I never really understood why I went into care. But then other people would be like, yeah, but you went through this or this happened or that happened. And in my head, it was like, no, but that's normal.
Right.
So why would you? All my friends ain't in care, so how comes I'm in care kind of thing? And so, yeah, that was for me probably one of the hardest things. But yeah, growing up, it was cool. Sometimes a struggle. It was crazy, but I got through it.
Did you ever feel like you had a sense of you were living in a sense of danger, or were there any moments, whether it be danger or whether it be just that still little voice inside you saying, maybe this is not quite right?
No, actually.
No.
Weirdly, no, because I felt very protected.
Okay.
In terms of, because everyone around me was doing the same thing, so they were all in the same environment. So I never saw danger because it wasn't dangerous to us because that was just normal.
Yeah.
And so like everyone around me, for instance, they, you know, including my, you know, my mum smoked weed, for instance, right? And that was something that I just grew up seeing all the time. And so other people would be like, well, isn't you know, that how do you take care of your kids if you're high all the time?
Yeah.
But we used to have just like a fun house, so all the kids would be in my house. So it was like we would have, you know, all the latest games consoles, so all the kids would be in my house and my mom and her friends would just be off smoking weed or doing whatever they were doing, and we was having a great old time because we was playing computer games, right? So for us it was just like, oh no, this is, you know, it's cool. So yeah, and I never felt unsafe at any point.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you recall the time when you're actually taken from your home?
I do, like, I have, like, really, really vague memories of it. And actually, I was talking with my mum just a few days ago about actually this one memory that I do have, which was when we first got taken, me and my brother. We was together and we got put in this Indian family. And I'll never forget it because, obviously, culturally, it's very different to what I grew up with. And I just remember just crying and them trying to, like, give me food. And I was just like, I wouldn't eat. And I just cried all day. And my brother, he was loving it. Like, he loved food. Yeah. So everything they would give him, he would just eat. So he was like having, and anytime he wanted food, he would just get it.
Yeah.
So he was having a whale of a time. He was just living his best life. And I was just there like, I don't know what this is. I don't know where I am. I don't want to be here. And I just cried a lot. And that was, that was kind of like.
How old were you and how old was your brother when you actually moved?
So I was six and my brother, he was eight when we got taken, so.
Did they, did anyone try and explain what was happening and why?
Yeah, they, so the thing is they did, but so you'd like get a social worker, they would come and they'd take you. And I remember the social worker saying to me, you know, your mom's just a little bit unwell, you'll see her soon, but yeah, we've got to take you and get you guys looked after until your mom gets better. And so that's something that always stuck with me because I always just thought that my mom was sick and that I was going to be going home soon. And I never went home. So,
oh, really?
I never went home. And so for me, that was something that stood out. And I always say, like, whenever I, you know, go and train social workers and stuff, I always say to them, I understand that you want to keep the young people safe and you don't, you know, you kind of, you want to put them in a place where they feel like they're going to see their family or whatever, but making those kinds of promises is something that young people never forget. And so you put them already in a vulnerable place by lying to them. So all I remember is I had a social worker, my social worker lied. You know, I'm not going to remember the good things or the things that he did do for me because I'm like, you lied to me.
But the lying was the thing that stood out to you as a small child.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So was it a long period of time till you actually ever saw your mum again, or what was the, was there any reconnection at any point?
So we did, so me and my brother, we had like, to be fair, we had probably the most easiest time in care that most young people wouldn't have had the same experience. In terms of our relationship with our mum. So I can't remember the exact details of how long it was. I'm pretty sure it was quite a while. But my mum, basically, she had a mental breakdown.
Right.
And so she had to get help. And so that's initially why, you know, we went into
taken
care.
Yeah.
And so when she got better, I remember just having times when every weekend we'd go to our house. So we'd stay over on the weekends.
Yeah.
And then school holidays, we'd go there as well and stay. So for us, it was a much easier process than a lot of other kids because most kids don't get to see their parents or they don't get to go home at all. So for me, that was cool because I got to stay with mum over the weekend or school holidays.
Yeah.
But the environment was still the same.
Yeah, it was difficult. You mentioned that you spent some time talking to care workers and so on. So.
Yep.
Now, further down the track, you're able to speak back into the life of kids that are going into care and those people that are helping to manage that.
So what I've done for the past, I think, like 15 or 16 years now is, so I do a lot of training. So I work with Barnardo's and other organisations and we go out and we train foster carers, we train social workers, social work students, and even young people. We sort of train with young people as well. And we just share our experiences and talk about what's important for young people or what was important for us when we was in care or what we needed, the support we didn't get and what they can do. So, you know, one of the biggest things for children in care is they just want to feel like someone cares. They just want to feel loved.
Yeah.
And one of the smallest things you can do to make someone feel like you care is just call them and ask if they're okay.
Mm.
And that's one of the things that never gets done. So I remember once doing a training with a social worker and they were like, but my young person only ever calls me when they need money. And I said, but what kind of relationship did you build with them?
Yeah.
When you call them, what do you ask them for? Because yeah. I know my social worker always called me and said, did you go to the dentist? Did you go to the doctors? Did you do this or did you do that? I never got a phone call to say, how are you today?
Yeah.
I never got a phone call to say, happy birthday. I never, you know, good luck on your exams.
Mm.
And those are the things that don't cost money.
Yeah.
And those are usually the things that young people want, but they're the things that they never yeah. give us. And so, of course, if you build a relationship of, what have you done? So when I want something, I'm going to call you because I want money or whatever it is, but I'm not going to call just to have a chat because you haven't built that relationship.
Okay, so what about then if you're working with these people now in the training,
mm-hmm.
what do you find and what sort of things do you come across that are biggest misconceptions that people have, whether they be people that want to be foster carers or whether they're people that are working in the social welfare area? But what are some of the biggest misconceptions that you think that we have for the kids that are in care?
There's so many.
Okay.
So many.
All right, can you pick up just a couple that really stand out to you?
Yeah, I'll pick a few. So one of the things for me is the whole thing about not succeeding.
Not succeeding.
Yes.
Yeah.
So how it works is if you see the statistics, you see that, you know, most young people don't go to university who've been in care. They don't have a great education and they're troubled and they're troublemakers and loads of, you know, other mm-hmm. stuff. But what I do think is that so many young people in care have like these wild imaginations and they have these wild plans of things that they want to achieve. But no one ever like cultivates that for them.
Yeah.
So all they get told all their life is, well, you're a child in care, so we don't expect you to do well. So because we don't expect you to do well, it doesn't really matter. So we're not going to support that. And so what happens is a lot of kids will just be like, well, I'm just going to play into the stereotype. Not because yeah. they're actually that, but it's just easier
yeah.
because they don't have that person behind them going, no, it's okay, you can do it. No, it's okay, let's achieve this thing. And so many kids, like, you know, in care and stuff, they don't go on to do things. They end up in prison or they end up dead or, you know, selling drugs or whatever it is. And it's because they don't have people to support that. And actually, you'll find if you sit down with a young person who's had like a mentor or someone who's had, you know, a great support network, they've gone on to do so many amazing things in life. And because, but no one expected it. And then yeah. everyone will be like, oh, that's so amazing. And it's like, actually, it's not that amazing. It's just because this one person has had the chance because people have believed in them.
Yeah.
And so I want it to just be the normal that everyone's like, you can do this. Let's support this,
yeah.
whatever it is that you want to do.
So you really want to be working on changing the narrative
yeah.
for those foster care leavers. Because the statistics are out there.
Of course.
And they're not made up. They're actually
they're real.
Actual data
yeah, yeah, yeah.
that's collected that proves that those some of those things are true.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to be, does it then?
Yeah, no, it doesn't have to be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how was life for you once you actually got to a point where you were, because correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe once you turned 18, is that right?
Yeah.
That then you're no longer a responsibility of the state
mm-hmm.
or the care system.
Yeah.
And you're just an isolated individual.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
So, yeah. So when I was growing up in care, that was the normal. When you turn 18,
yeah.
you leave and then that was it. You wouldn't get no support. Now it's changed a bit.
Okay.
So I think, if I'm not mistaken, I can't be 100% sure yeah. on this, but I think the age went to 21.
Okay.
But if you're in education, it's up to the age of 25. So if you're in university or anything like that, then they support you till 25.
Who's they when you say they support
social
you? Social services.
Will so support you.
What about if you're in a home? Are you still in that in a family environment?
At 18?
Yep.
Most likely not. So they do have a new thing called, this thing called stay input. But most people don't do it because what happens is when you turn 18, because your status kind of changes as a child in care.
Yeah.
So you're not a child in care or care leaver. So if you stay put in, for instance, a foster home, they don't get paid the same amount of money they would if you was in care.
Right.
And so a lot of times what happens is people turn 18 and they're like, well, I'm not going to get the same money. So you kind of got to go.
Right.
Because I want to be able to make a living, essentially. Yeah. And so a lot of the time you'll just end up leaving.
Yeah, which is, I mean, you just said I want to make a living.
Yeah.
That kind of makes me a little bit sad just hearing you say that. But
it's the truth.
Yeah.
And
yeah. I'm sure it is. I'm sure that it's a very complex situation, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I'm sure there are great people out there that want to foster kids.
Oh, 100%.
And want to do it with the out of the goodness of their heart because they want to give kids a better opportunity.
Yeah.
But then I'm sure there are also people out there that are doing it because it is. It's a form of income for them.
Yeah.
So they don't really necessarily want to do it necessarily for the kids.
Exactly.
But that's an income.
Yeah, exactly. So there are definitely lots of great foster carers.
Yeah.
And there are ones who don't do it for the money, but still, I guess it becomes like the routine yeah. in a way. So it's like, it's kind of like if you was in any other job and they was like, we want you to do the same job, but we're going to give you less money.
Yeah.
You're not really going to be like, okay, then let's just do that.
Yeah.
So I don't blame some of them for having that kind of mindset. But then there are some who are just literally there for money, and you can always tell the ones that are there just for the money. But yeah, it is difficult turning 18 and then having to like figure out your way around life without, you know, a good home, without the right support. Because when you turn 18, you change from having a social worker to having a PA, which is a very different setup. So you see them less, or if you see them at all, that is.
Yeah.
And then financially, it's the only thing that happens is financially you get more money than you would if you was in care. But money isn't, you know, a thing that's going to help you when you're crying out.
That's right. It's not everything, is it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so. It's like that someone that's just going to say, happy birthday, hope you're having a great day, that kind of thing, which doesn't take the money. It's just someone that's a family group around you that cares about you.
Exactly.
Yeah. Which then kind of leads me then to, I want to hear what you have to say about why you started the concept of the Care Leavers Christmas dinner.
All right. So I'll just talk a little bit about my journey, I guess.
Do it.
So when I went into care, eventually I ended up living with my nan, and she was like a strong Christian. So I grew up in church. And then when I left, I left at 18 to live on my own, and I struggled a lot with just having an understanding of why I was in care, what had happened, what happened while I was in care as well. Because a lot of, you know, so when I lived with my nan, it was a bit of a struggle as well. And so I was processing all of that, and it was hard. And so I kind of like lost my faith in a way. And so I got into like this deep, dark place of depression and, you know, these suicidal thoughts and all types of stuff. And I was on my own. I was in Luton, and I felt like I didn't have no one. I felt like I didn't have anything. And so I got into a lot of stupid situations during that time, because I would have these so-called friends that would be around. So I would get into like all these silly, silly situations. So one of the situations, I had a friend who, we was just hanging out one day and we had no money, hungry. And she was like, oh, let's go out and get a gun, right, and rob people at the cash machine. And so I was like, that's a great idea, right?
Okay.
Yeah. But like I said, like the environment I grew up in, staying with my mom and stuff, it meant that was normal for us. Mm. So me being, you know, silly, I was just like, yeah, that's a great idea. And so we called my oldest brother. So I have an older brother. My oldest brother, and we was like, we need a gun, and he was like, okay, come and get it. And so we went to his house literally and got a gun, and I was like, listen, but just make sure that there's no, you know, there's no clip in there, there's no bullets in there, because I'm not trying to kill anyone, like I don't want to go to jail. So I've left his house with this gun, and I'm walking down the street, and we're like, yeah, we're gonna go rob people, we're gonna get some money because we're hungry. And then something in my heart was like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Like, this isn't your character. This isn't who you are. And actually, it's not sensible. And then on the way back to go and take the gun back to his house, I saw the police. And I started sweating. Like, literally, I was sweating because, you know, I was wearing a tracksuit. So I looked like a boy. I was in Tottenham. And I was thinking, I'm going to jail today. Yeah. Like, literally, I was like, I'm going to jail today. And I walked past them, tried to act normal, and as soon as I got past them, I literally ran to my brother's house, and I was like, here you go, like, I never want to see one of these again.
Yeah.
And by the grace of God, I never had to, and I never used it, and I didn't rob anyone. But it was just stupid.
One of the stupid things.
Yeah, it was one of the stupid things.
But see, even that kind of that little voice
Yeah.
I believe God's got his eye on you.
Oh, 100%.
So that little voice, that little thing that kind of just niggles on you on the inside, in your heart, in your mind, that just kind of goes, what are you doing? This is crazy.
Yeah.
This does not make sense.
Yeah.
Was just a God just kind of ushering you the right direction. Thank for God you listened.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
So, so I would get into loads of silly stuff like that. And then I joined this group, which is called Children's Rights. And so they were an organization that helped young people who were care leavers in terms of like supporting them in training, in independent skills, and then just getting, you know, our voice heard. You know, we did things like, you know, changing law and all that kind of stuff using this organization. And so we built up this like really amazing, beautiful family. There was like about 30 plus of us.
Yeah.
And we loved each other dearly. Like, I would literally do anything for any of them. So there was a lot. So I think I was one of the oldest, actually. So there was myself and then there was a few other older ones. And then Topi, he was one of the older ones as well. We just built this family and we would always like advocate for each other. And unfortunately, in 2010, Topi, he was like probably like one of the happiest people I've ever met. Like, he was always happy, he was always smiling, and he was always just supportive of other people. And so, we had this great bond. And then in 2010, he committed suicide.
Yeah.
And for us as a group, it was probably the hardest thing. Like, going into care was a breeze in comparison for me. In fact, in that process, I got to a point where I understood why he killed himself.
Right.
Because it was so painful just facing that and looking in the eyes of people that you love and they're so broken and you can't help them. For me, that was like the hardest thing I've ever had to deal with. And so after that process, there was like a bunch of the younger ones who were like 14, 13, some of them were 15 at the time, and a few of them were actually in the process of moving out. So some of them were, I think they were 16, and they were moving out into independent living. And that's like, you know, pretty young to be on your own. So a lot of them, they would come to my house and we'd hang out and we'd do dinner and all that kind of stuff. I'd support them. And, you know, one of the young people I remember on the day of Topi's funeral, I was just holding her and she was crying. And in that moment, I said to myself, I'm never going to allow this to happen again. I made it my responsibility because I was like, I can't be this broken and I can't see other people be this broken. So we spent a lot of time together. This happened in like September time, and then Christmas came about and I was like, hey guys, like, you guys are all moving out, you're gonna live on your own, should we do Christmas together? And they were like, yeah, let's do Christmas. And I was like, well, I'm not gonna cook.
So that's what I would say. I'm not gonna cook, you can come over but I'm not cooking.
Yeah, so I was like, and then they were like, well, we can't cook, so, you know, what are we gonna do? So we called my nan and I was like, hey nan, you know, there's a bunch of us, we want to do Christmas, can we do it at your house? And she was like, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah.
And so my nan cooked, and that year there was five young people.
Yeah.
And then the next year, we was just like,
you decided, hey, to nan, do it again.
Yeah, it was like, hey nan, do you want to do Christmas for us again? And she was like, yeah. And this time there was 11 young people that came. And I'll never forget that day my auntie came to the house and she said her favorite moment was when she opened the door and she just saw like a sea of kids, like in pajamas and stuff, watching EastEnders. And she said that moment made her whole Christmas. And it was so beautiful. Like, you know, we just had that family vibe. Yeah. And so that was in 2011.
Yeah.
And then I met a kid about 3 months later, I think it was. And he was like, I wish someone cared about me that much. And I said, I do care about you that much. And so myself and one of my friends who came for Christmas, we was like, what can we do?
Yeah,
let's make this happen. And so in 2012, we started the Topi Project, which was our first ever Care Leavers Christmas with 100 young people.
And where did you do that?
Well, not in my nan's house.
No. Wow, your nan has a big kitchen.
Yeah, I know, right?
Big lounge room.
So we did it in in a church crypt.
Yeah.
In Elephant and Castle. Yeah. So we did that for a few years there.
And who did the cooking for that?
Actually, my friend's auntie.
Yeah.
Her aunties did it for the first, like, I think it was like 2 years.
Yeah.
They cooked. And then eventually we moved it to another, and this is what's so weird about the process. So first it was in a church crypt, right?
Yeah.
Then it moved to a youth centre, but it was a Christian youth centre called the Salmon Centre, which is in Bermondsey. And then that year my mum cooked along with a few of her friends and like some of my aunties and stuff. And so every year since then we've just done Christmas for young people.
And then
I met Amy Glover, who comes to the church.
Yeah.
And she was always like, the church want to help. And I'm like, no. Because at this point, I was like 100% against church, against Christians.
Oh, okay. So that's the reason you didn't want church to be involved. Yeah,
I personally anti-church. Was anti-church. I was anti-Christian humans.
What was the tipping point in all of this?
Then eventually the tipping point was when I got saved. So I got saved and then I was like, okay, then we'll let the church help.
So someone invited you to church, or how did you actually encounter the message of Christ?
So I went to America. My cousin invited me to church and I met a pastor who she literally like loved me back to Christ. Like literally, that's what it was like. And so I went to church and she done a service and it was beautiful. And at the end of the service, she prayed. And when she was praying, her words were, Lord, help us forgive the people who have abandoned us. And in that moment, I started crying. Like, I bawled out my eyes. And the first person that came to my mind was my dad.
Yeah.
And there was something in my heart that was saying, you need to forgive him. You need to forgive him. And I was like, but I don't want to forgive him. But I was crying and I was like, I don't want to. And I knew it was God telling me, I've got you. Like, it's okay, but you need to forgive him. And so in that moment, literally, like, that was a turning point for me. And, yeah, I called my brother and I was like, can you tell my dad that I forgive him and that I love him? And then when I came back to the UK, she was like, where are you going to go to church? And I was like, I don't know. And then I called Amy and I was like,
oh,
hey.
So how did you know Amy?
So she just helped us with the project.
At
Christmas. Yeah. Yep. And so I called Amy and I was like, hey, Amy, you're never going to guess what happened. And Amy was like, what happened? And I told her and she was like, I've been praying for this moment since I met you.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow. That's such a beautiful thing that I have a friend who actually prayed for me. And so I was like, well, you know, she told me about Hillsong, so maybe I might come. And she was like, yeah, come, I'll bring you.
Did you think it was a weird name?
No, I never knew anything about Hillsong. I was just like, what's this Hillsong thing? But I was like, I was willing to come, and she said she'll come with me to the first service. So she took me to Tottenham Court Road.
Yeah.
And actually, because it was so dark and you could just go in and come out, I liked hiding as well.
Yes.
So I just I went in. No one noticed me. I left, and then I just started going to North London. So, so that's kind of how I found the church.
Okay, so then you got to a point where you went, all right, well, if the church can help us, pull off this Christmas lunch, then you're willing to do that.
So I was like, I got to a point where for me it was hard. Because every year we was giving so much less and less people were willing to help. And because none of us get paid to do it. So we all do it for free. And so everyone had to have full-time jobs and stuff like that. And there was literally two of us left every year, like hosting and creating this Christmas. Yeah. And we was just like, I'm tired.
Yeah.
Last year I was like, I'm tired. And Amy said, oh, the church really want to help again. And I was like, to be honest, this year I feel like you guys should just do it. I was like, the church can just do it, and I'm just going to spend Christmas with my family. And so that's what we did last year.
Yeah.
The church like created and hosted and done all the amazing stuff last year, and this year we're doing it together in partnership, so it's amazing.
And the church absolutely loved doing that and getting behind that. With our church, there's a number of ways that we can all get behind Christmas giving, and there's a number of different avenues, and this is just one of them.
Yeah.
Because it may not suit everybody to be able to give their Christmas day up to be either cooking food or serving food or preparing food or clearing away or chatting with people and so on. It just doesn't work for everybody.
Yeah.
But it does work for some people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole bunch of people actually that really want to get behind that and that have done it in the past and are willing to do it again this year.
Cool.
And are completely up for it. As I said, there's a number of different ways that we can do church Christmas giving through church. But this is just one thing. And I think it's incredible. I saw some of the pictures. I wasn't here last year.
Yeah.
But I saw some of the pictures of the tables that were set out.
It's beautiful.
And like candles and all the plates and the cups and the saucers and the silverware and everything was all set up. And the table set up beautifully, all of the Bermondsey Warehouse. And Have you got any stories from any of your friends that went to that dinner last year?
Yeah, no, everyone, it was absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
But everyone loved it. Their favourite thing was they had computer games.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, so they had this corner with loads of computer games like Mario Kart and football and all types of stuff. And the kids loved it. Like, they were just like, this is like my favourite Christmas ever. The food was amazing. They loved the food. And everyone just said that it was so full of like just love, and they got to watch a movie on the big screen, like on beanbags at the end of the night, and that was probably most people's highlights from Christmas was the movie. Everyone just thought it was amazing. It was full of love, and it was it felt like a family environment. So that was the most important part, which is so that was great for them.
Yeah. Just to give these kids that kind of sense of, well, Christmas is special.
Yeah.
And Christmas can be special.
Exactly.
It's not worth taking your life for or
nope.
or being alone,
mm-hmm.
that you can get connected and you can have something that's just a really fun environment.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So, Charlize, you've been through some difficult times,
mm-hmm.
but you're also achieving something now.
Yeah.
But if someone was listening and they're going through a difficult time,
mm-hmm.
what are some of those threads? What are some of those things that you really held on to help pull you through and get you to doing what you're doing today?
So I have like a process that I go through actually when I'm going through a difficult time. And so I'm not saying that everyone should do this, but it's something that's helped me. And I think you should, as a human being, just kind of learn who you are and what works for you.
Yeah.
But my process is really just, so first of all, I accept whatever it is that's happened. Because I think as humans, what we do is we replay stuff in our head, and because we didn't want it to happen, we have all these like really negative feelings about it. But one thing we don't do is accept that it actually happened. And so when you get to a place where you can accept it, it's like, well, it's happened, so I can't change that now.
Mm.
And so acceptance for me is like the key thing. It's like, okay, when I can get to a place where I'm like, oh, okay, well, it actually happened, and it's okay that it happened, then the next process for me is actually just, I cry it out. I'm not going to lie. Like, I literally just cry. Like, I'll just be like, God.
Tears cry.
Yeah. Like, I'll just cry it out. I'll be like, God, you know, this is how I feel about this thing. And I want to let it go now. And so I literally like hand it to God. Like, God, this is, I'm giving it to you now. Like, I've been through this. I've beat myself up about it for this long. And this isn't what you planned for me. So actually, Here it is. Like, I'm accepting it happened, and now I'm giving it to you. Here it is. And then I just kind of like do stuff to make me happy. So like, I'll just like play computer games or listen to like really amazing music or whatever, like for a couple of days, just to get like my spirit back up and happy again. And obviously I continue praying about it. And that's kind of like my process. And also I've been to counseling.
Yeah.
And I'm about to do some therapy as well. I think that's really important.
Yeah.
So those are just kind of a few processes.
Why do you think therapy is important?
I think it's important because it's kind of like a non-judgmental space.
Yeah.
Obviously, having friends to speak to who are not judgmental is cool. But actually, with therapy, they get you to a place where you kind of like, I guess for me, it feels like you get to a place where you do accept something. So it's like you go to therapy and you talk about stuff and you can say how you feel and blah, blah, blah. And then in the end, it's just like, oh, I accepted this and that's it. And then you get steps to kind of like, you know, help you to, you know, get through whatever it is that you're going through at that point, and just to keep you positive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very good. Wisdom from Charlize. Very, very good.
Yeah.
All right then, Charlize. I just would love to know what you're looking forward to for even this year's, because it's not that far, it's just around the corner.
Yep.
This year, I can't believe how fast this year's gone. But just around the corner, this year or even into next year, 2020,
yep.
and the Christmas dinner, what do you imagine that to look like?
Yeah, no, I think Christmas dinner is going to be amazing. I'm going to be in my pyjamas.
Oh, is that what everyone should wear, pyjamas?
If they want to. we're always open to everyone wearing pyjamas or onesies, whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
But I think for me, I'm in this like season of growth.
Yeah.
And God's been speaking to me about preparing the soil.
Yeah.
I've been on this journey of like just preparing myself, like my soil, in terms of just letting go of things that have happened in the past, growing through that and then getting to a point where I can share in a positive way with people. And so I'm looking forward to just being able to stand on platforms, hopefully next year, and just talk about my experience and my journey and changing lives, hopefully. So, yeah. That's it. Yeah, that's what I'm...
Okay, have you got anything, any platforms in mind next year or anything that's already...
Actually, One Young World. I really want to speak at One Young World next year.
Hang on, what is that?
So it's just an amazing summit that happens every year where they get young leaders around the world together and they have these like 4 days of speakers and people sharing their stories and what they're doing to help either like to do with like equality or to do with education, to do with climate change, anything like across the board. So I really want to speak at that next year. That would be
amazing. Is that in London?
No, it was in London this year. Next year it's going to be in Munich. I'm asking God for that. So I'll put it out now.
You've got something to say.
Yes, I do. I've been invited to loads of like different events to just speak at, like just speaking at those and inspiring people, hopefully.
Okay, you are an incredible lady.
Thank you.
There is no doubt about that.
I appreciate that.
We are blown away. I know you were, before we started, you were a little bit like, I'm a little bit nervous. I don't know if I haven't really got anything to say. But we are all sitting here going, wow, incredible. Look what you have done. Look what you have overcome.
Yeah.
There is no doubt about it. You have overcome an awful lot.
Yeah.
But what's exciting is that there is so much more.
Yes.
Laying ahead for you. 100%. Who knows? God says to dream big.
Yes.
He says, like, over and above, more. Just dream bigger. Just imagine.
Yeah.
And you're only still a young person yourself, so there's still a lot of time left. And we're excited that as a church that we can partner with you.
Thank you.
And being able to do something and making life's, well, at least one day.
Yeah. I know, I appreciate that. I
special.
Think, yeah, no, I definitely appreciate it. I think for me, like, it's been such an honour just to be able to have the church, like, supporting. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And being in an environment that people actually love and support what you do and help you grow is just beautiful. So thank you, guys. Yeah.
Awesome. You did it so well. Well, that's it for today. Thanks for listening. Why not join in the conversation on social media? You can follow us as Convos with Kathy on both Instagram and Facebook, where it's now easier than ever to share an encouraging podcast with your friends. Till next time, see ya.